Okay, so this week's subject is right effort, and I think it's no coincidence that this sits right in the middle of the Eightfold Path. It's a very important aspect of the path. So if we come back to our analogy of the journey, our right view, if you recall, is the final destination. And that may change as we go through our journey. We may discover, actually, didn't want to go there in the first place. Don't fancy Tesco's today. I'm going to head for Sainsbury's instead. Other supermarkets are available. Right intent, that governs the choices we make during our journey to help us get there. And then we have right speech, right action, and right livelihood, which you can kind of look on as the baggage that we carry, we take along with us to support us and help us get there. Or, of course, not. We can carry baggage that's too heavy for us and takes us off track. This next group can be brought together and put under one heading of concentration. So here we've got right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And the three can be seen as collected together. If our journey's going to be long, we're actually going to need a degree of tenacity and clarity of mind to get there. The group of right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, these are all supporting our approach to the journey. Not the actual mechanisms of it, but the way we feel about it and how we make sure we continue to drive ourselves forward. And of course, again, it's all about mind. It's a state of mind. So our mental approach to the journey. And of course, now, with meditation, we can see a stronger association with this part of the Eightfold Path. It's much clearer. We'll take a look at concentration itself in a couple of weeks. Today we're going to drill down specifically into effort. And as I said at the start, it's absolutely crucial to our success on the journey. It's interesting, if we don't actually arrive at our destination for some reason, we might like to blame the traffic. Or we could blame other road users. There's lots of things to blame. But at the end of the day, actually, we have to take full responsibility ourselves for our journey, uncomfortable as that may be. So let's take a quick look at this modern world of ours. And it's actually interesting, I think, what's going on, because we're all on different journeys. But it seems that our lifestyle is providing us with more and more ways to step away from that uncomfortable feeling of responsibility. So as an illustration, it's a doozy, this one. Recreational vehicles. Those big RVs. And this is about a chap that bought one of these big Winnebagos, big American things. And he purchased this vehicle and it had cruise control. Bet you can guess where this is going already. So the man decided one day, during his journey, to get up and leave the wheel and make a cup of tea. Unsurprisingly, the vehicle left the road. What was surprising was he successfully sued the company, because nowhere in the manual did it say that he couldn't leave the wheel, even while the vehicle was in motion. Now, personally, I think that's outrageous. Even if this man had some sort of mental health issue here, that was his responsibility, difficult or otherwise. So that's one example. Here's a second.
That is
a true story. And here's a second true story. That one was in America. This one was in the UK. So this is a lady that was in one of the big baby superstores shopping. And she was shopping for clothes for her baby. And she stepped back and fell over a pushchair. She sued the company for not providing adequate parking spaces for pushchairs in the shop. Successfully sued them. The problem was, the pushchair she fell over was hers. She'd parked it there. So
that's America.
Well, that one was the UK.
Oh, no.
Yeah. That one was the UK. So right effort, a big part of it is actually about stepping up and taking full responsibility for our own journey, fully and completely. But I've got to qualify this. Right effort is definitely about having drive and tenacity, but it is also about having a sense of friendship towards ourselves. So we have to balance this out. It's no good at all if we drive ourselves so hard we make ourselves ill. We must find the balance. Knowing when we're working too hard or knowing when we aren't is the key here. And the Buddha painted an interesting picture with this one. He described it like holding a frog. He said, when you hold a frog, if you don't hold it tight enough, it will squeeze out between your fingers. If you hold it too tight, you'll squish it. So you've got to find it just right, the middle way. So to this, what's key here is actually self-honesty and a dispassionate view. You've got to be brutally honest with yourself, and that's difficult. And you've also got to be dispassionate to be able to step outside of your story and look at it and ask yourself, am I balancing right effort? Am I putting enough in, or am I pushing myself too hard? Tricky. I see a lot of people with physical difficulties who battle through life and carry on. We've had remarkable people on our retreats with blindness, other physical difficulties, and they come along on the retreats and they study something as difficult to learn as Tai Chi. It's absolutely remarkable. But I also see others with physical difficulties who regularly use those difficulties to explain why they can't continue in their direction. It's all a balance. Taunton, last year in the snow, closed. Absolutely closed. But many people who work in the town live in the town. Why did the town close? It was right that they didn't drive to work. That was definitely a sensible choice. But why not pop their boots on and enjoy the fresh, clean air and take a stroll through the snow? Perhaps, for many, the snow day was a nice excuse to take an extra day's free holiday. Now, I can fully sympathise with that. However, the Sangha house stayed open, I'll just point out. I do respect that position with work. But if we have the same mindset with our attitude towards spiritual progress, we'll certainly never get there. So what is it that stops us from making the right effort? To arrive at our destination, that effort has to be made up of two things: commitment and conviction. Commitment actually gets us going in the first place. This is the base of why we kick off something. Involved in there is our emotional driver. What is it that kicks us off actually often it's emotion. We get excited about something, we get interested about something, and it kicks us off. And actually, that commitment, that emotional driver, if we're going to sustain ourselves on the journey, that needs to be there under the surface all the time. If we lose that, our commitment will die. There's a real opportunity, therefore, at the start of the journey, when we look at that emotional driver, to really examine how we feel. Shinru Suzuki talks about keeping the beginner's mind. And he's saying many things there, but one thing he is saying is remember what it likes to be a beginner and really hold on to that and let that carry you through, actually. So when your interest is waning, cast your mind back to how you felt at the start. Big opportunity. So the emotions are important, which is why, you know, and all of these aspects of the Eightfold Path tie into each other. They're never separate. So this is why mindfulness is so important, because actually through the practice of mindfulness, we can really deeply get in touch with the emotions, study them, see how we feel, and pop that in the back of our memories and pull it out when we need to. Then you need the conviction. Actually, this keeps you going when the enthusiasm does wane. Just think about New Year's resolutions. The number of these that fall by the wayside. There's usually loads of commitment at the start, but the conviction fades after a few weeks. So how do we deal with this? How do we keep our conviction going? Mostly, the killer of conviction is doubt. And often it's false doubt. Yeah. So, meditation, for example. You know, as somebody new to meditation gets very keen, decides to set their shrine out every day and sit down and meditate. After a few months, start thinking, not making much progress. Mind's as busy as ever. It doesn't work. It doesn't work for me. False doubt. That is false doubt. Tackle the false doubt. Look at it head on. Look it in the eye. And ask yourself, hang on, meditation. That's actually lasted for thousands of years. People have been practicing this for thousands of years. And do I really believe that all those thousands of generations of people meditating before me found it easy? Of course they didn't. But they did knuckle down, they did push on through, and we know they made progress. So it's false doubt. And when you apply this approach to the doubt, remove the doubt, conviction returns. Interesting way to look at it. The other challenge we have, of course, is all of the lovely stuff that this life gives us that takes us off track. There's so many things that we can do these days, so much opportunity, so many different things to eat, and so many ways to occupy ourselves. These provide essentially a distraction, pull us away from our spiritual goal, because it's nicer. And again, this is where our mindfulness comes in, and our awareness of how we respond to desire and aversion, how we look at our craving, and we look at the way we push things away that are potentially perceived as unpleasant through our five senses. So the practice we had the other week, we looked at renunciation through fasting. It's a really good way to tackle this particular type of distraction, because we can experience the nature of physical craving and the difference between that and mental craving, the body's need and the mind's desire, and start to really understand that. So, let's take a look at what the Buddha said about right effort. Again, the Buddha looked at wholesome and unwholesome, sitting behind all of these areas we've looked at before. Desire and craving, aversion, ill will, versus generosity, self-discipline, kindness, concentration, and understanding for others. So it all comes back to this, actually. We can look at our challenges with applying our effort and see what's wholesome and what isn't. So the Buddha said that our effort is there to, firstly, prevent the arising of unarisen, unwholesome states, mental states. There's lots of double negatives in there, isn't there? And secondly, to abandon existing unwholesome states. So those mental states that have already arisen in our minds, to abandon them. It's an interesting word, abandon. It's not push away. It's just leave behind. Let it go. It's got a different feel to push away. And then, thirdly, to arouse wholesome states that have not yet arisen. And finally, to cultivate wholesome states that are already present. And you can see these as kind of a little mini path of their own right. You know, so the initial focus is to let go of the unwholesome, and then you arrive at cultivating the wholesome. He definitely suggests doing it in that order. And when I think about this, I think it's because of the potential for confusion, particularly in our modern society, when you look at all the things that are on offer to us. And actually, if we don't do it this way round, some of the things that are on offer, we can actually misinterpret as wholesome when they're not. So it's a better way to approach it, if you like. We now, of course, start to cross over into meditation, because these are all states of mind. So there's nothing practical here. There's nothing we have to physically do. It's all mental process. Which is why the self-honesty is so important. If we don't have that, we won't go anywhere. I mean, I think that's important. In Buddhist practice, there is no third party watching us, casting judgment. There's no spirit. So it's entirely down to us. If we choose not to, there won't be any retribution from a third party. But we won't make progress. It's as simple as that. So that pure self-honesty is absolutely important. Our mind state, from a meditation perspective, we can view as a container. It's got a particular shape. And when we put our life into this container, our life will take that shape. The good news is, our mind is malleable and shapeable through effort, and therefore we can create a shape that's actually wholesome. It's an interesting one, isn't it? So, in simple terms, we can carry out a practice that I like to practice each day. So, as I rise in the morning, I say to myself, today I'm going to avoid harming others in any way I can. An ideal which actually proves impossible, as we sometimes hurt one person to avoid hurting another. But the purpose here isn't to necessarily achieve that ideal. It's not necessarily about outward change, it's about inward change. If we set that ideal in our minds in the morning, then that is casting a shape across our mind, and our life pours into that shape and takes that shape. The more we practice in this way, the more we start to notice how our thoughts change and how our attitude to life changes. We practiced recently the Metta Bhavana. This meditation is a true transformational meditation, and this one does very much reshape our minds, focuses on that malleability. Essentially, what you can look at from a sort of more scientific perspective, if you like, is here we're working on the subconscious mind and the subconscious intent. It's there that we change the shape of our minds, not the conscious bit, actually. So how do we do that? Because by definition, our subconscious, it's not conscious. So we're not thinking about it. It's sitting back there, influencing our lives. And the answer is meditation. This is what we're doing, actually. And as I've said many times before, when we sit on the cushion, we're essentially training habit into the subconscious mind. We're not necessarily making a great deal of progress when we sit on the cushion, but we are changing the nature of that subconscious mind. When we make progress is when we get off the cushion and apply right intent and right action, right mindfulness, etc. in our lives. So, actually, what helps take us forward is a view of progress. If we don't see progress, it's going to be difficult to retain that conviction, and therefore the commitment might melt away and right effort crashes down. So it is good to see progress. So how do you see progress with the subconscious mind? Well, the answer is you look at the behaviour of the mind during meditation. And there are some key markers here. Today we're going to use the mindfulness of breathing again. And the key marker with the mindfulness of breathing is the time it takes between periods when the mind wanders. So as you practice, you will find that you can sustain your concentration on the breath for a little longer, and then the mind wanders, and then you bring it back. So that's the first marker. And of course, what's keeping it sustained is habit, and that is being driven by the subconscious mind. And then the second marker is the speed you come back. So the mind wanders off, but it comes back. And you find, as you make progress, that the mind wanders for less and less time. What's bringing it back? Because by definition, if the mind's wandered, it's wandered. But something brings you back. Lo and behold, it's your subconscious. Sitting in the background there, the subconscious mind is going, "Oi, you're supposed to be meditating." And so it brings you back. And of course, the quicker that starts to happen, the more you get an indication of progress. Okay. So we're going to keep things nice and simple with the meditation today. We shall use our mindfulness of breathing through the body scan. We use the word still to bring ourselves into our place. And then we're just going to bring our minds to the very tip of the nose, the Anapana spot, and center our concentration there. And just try and kind of keep half your attention aware of how your meditation's going, when it wanders, how long it wanders for, when it comes back. Just start getting into a habit of observing it in this way as you pour all your concentration into that point. Okay? That's what we're going to do. Any questions? Any thoughts?
There is another level, which is a dangerous level, which is a blended attention level.
Ah, yes.
Whereas you're in the middle of meditation, you're aware, you're awake, and you can actually see the thoughts. The thought and the awareness are together. So you're actually aware. The real danger is that you suddenly, that awareness makes you aware that you're actually enlightened, if you like. You know, you're actually aware and being able to see a thought from beginning to end come through and leave. But then what happens is you then become aware or get lost in the thought that you've done it. You know, so it's a very dangerous place to be because it's very interesting that you're actually able to hold your attention on a thought, but the thought hasn't taken over and taken it away.
They're interesting things, thoughts, aren't they, these mental objects, because one thing I like to do is just to kind of take the power out of a thought just by doing exactly that. What is that thought like? What is its nature? Does it have a beginning and an end? Can you feel it as it passes through the mind? Has it got a texture? And when you try and do it, actually, they tend to evaporate like gossamer.
Exactly.
You know. And obviously, you know, then the danger is that you start thinking about the nature of thought and you're off on one.
Yes.
So I think, again, that self-honesty thing. I mean, the other thing that can arise, of course, is, wow, I've been sitting for ages concentrated on my breath. Aren't I amazing? Aren't I awesome? I'm a fantastic meditator. And the pride cuts in and all of that.
It's all about me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I found a fascinating thing that the more I've been doing it, when you say that you meditate but you don't learn it until you take it out. You know I meditate in colour because I've told you.
Yeah.
I now find that if I'm doing something and just going about my normal business, and a thought comes into my mind that I particularly don't want, my subconscious takes me straight to that colour.
Right. Gosh, okay.
And that's relatively new. Since I've been coming here. I mean,
right.
I've done other things a long time. But that just made me think about what you say. You practice on the mat.
Yeah.
But it comes
naturally
sometimes.
And those understandings are brilliant, because that's a key part of making this progress. You know, I mean, the Buddha's teaching, it gave us some signposts, but actually each and every one of us is going to have a complete different experience of this journey, because our minds are so infinitely complex. But we have to kind of pick up these little signals of what works for us.
So that's a good thing.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. One of my teachers, a monk called Iradara, he kind of had a sound thing going on, and he used the sound of the sea with his breath when he found he overlaid concentration on the breath just with the simple sound of the sea. It took him in. So I think the senses are really important in meditation. Yeah, definitely.
Two things struck me in that. First, the idea of right effort being a mental activity.
Yes.
which, when you said it, took me by surprise a little bit. I was thinking all the time, right effort, that's all about what we do.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's still about the mind.
Completely.
And the other thing was self-doubt.
All stout.
Is there somewhere in which all doubt? Is there a true doubt?
Good question.
Can we ask the question, those serious questions, about any time that we doubt?
Yeah. I think that's probably a healthy way to approach it, isn't it? Because if you do ask those questions, you are looking at doubt in the face, and therefore you probably discover the sheer number of doubts that actually are false.
But doubt can drive you on, can't it? So it isn't that you need doubt to drive you on.
Okay. Explain.
If you do what he said, you know, make it, question it.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's going to cripple you.
Yes.
So, I would ask: is it doubt that's driving you on there, or is it your emotion?
Yes, it's a confidence thing, isn't it? So, if you doubt, then think through that doubt.
Let's take a hard example. So, the doubt may be a doubt in inability in self.
Yes.
So, you want to improve. You know, you want to improve a skill or a particular approach because you're doubting that you have a particular ability. Now, actually, what's driving you on isn't the doubt. What's driving you on is the desire to introduce that skill in your life and to improve it. That's the emotional thing.
Again, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, starting to learn the left side of Tai Chi... The beginner's mind is both, oh, this is interesting and exciting, and I will never get this, ever. So it's the beginner's mind is
full of doubt,
as well as, oh, well, I really want to have a go at this, but, oh, never.
So it's the emotion, not the doubt, that's right, yes, because if you have doubt, but then you overcome that doubt. That's your mind that's working.
It's the overcoming that's key.
Yeah.
And that's the emotion, that's that initial commitment to crack on with this.
You have to do what Andy said, question it.
Yeah.
And
then conviction.
Conviction is where the doubt sits. The opposite of conviction is doubt. I guess the opposite of commitment, i.e. the emotional kickoff, is just kind of a dull, can't be bothered, sloth and torpor, we call it in Buddhism.
Like starting writing your Christmas cards or something.
Yes.
There's this idea as well about our thoughts actually, you know, we can have very directive thought, where we actually can turn and face what's worrying us or what is there, and really face it. And Buddhism helps us to actually really think about things thoroughly. The problem area is when we fantasize. We're sort of half-thinking and we wallow in this fantasy, which then develops into anxiety. Like a hot chocolate. When can I go shopping at Lidl's? What am I going to get those in? Are they going to run out? And it's like the mind is like, and you're not there with it at all. Your mind's just doing this over here, and you're actually not even awake. You're sort of in a fantasy world. That's a really difficult place.
It's the challenge we have being a human, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, we've got, I think what contributes to that are the two types of awareness that we've got, because we have got a very concentrated awareness. We've got the ability to look at one object, one situation, and focus on it. But that doesn't save our life when we step off the curb and there's a bus coming. And actually, we've also got this very open awareness collecting in all the impressions. And lo and behold, the corner of our eye picks up the bus and we leap back on the curb. You know, if all we had was our concentrated awareness, we'd get run over every day. So they're really important aspects of who we are and what we are. And I think these contribute to our thinking. You know, it's that open awareness that actually creates this kind of style of thinking, which is very random. It kind of comes from that layer of the mind that I talk about, where the top layer is your big juggernaut thoughts, your real concentrated awareness. But sitting below, you've got the foam. You've got these tiny little thoughtlets that are firing up all the time. And those are contributing to, well, our experience, and some of them become big juggernaut thoughts. And of course, we have to take it right back to basics here, because remember the idea of the sense doors and the Vedanas. So every single sense impression that passes through us goes through a process, it hits the sense doors and it becomes something because the mind has registered it. But at that point in time, we're not conscious of that sense awareness. It's pure sense at the moment. It's a sight, it's a touch, whatever. What happens next is the mind puts it into one of three camps, like, dislike, or neutral. And then the embellishment starts. We justify the choice. So every single one of our sense experiences goes through this. Well, here's the gig. In Buddhist psychology, we believe there's a sixth sense, and that's the mind itself. And its sense triggers our thoughts. So now you've got a real recursive process going on, because even the thoughts themselves have a sense door that passes through that choice mechanism. So a thought hits the mind, and the mind goes like, dislike, or neutral, and then the mind embellishes the thought and goes, I like that thought because of this, because, you know, it's led me to these places before, which I've been happy with. So it's a very, very complex process that's going on here. And the only way, it's just like Tai Chi, the only way to get to grips with it and study it is to slow it all down. And
why did you do a double speed the other day?
It's good for us every now and then. Yeah. And then you can start to get to grips with these processes that are going on, take an interest in them. Look at that. That's what my mind's doing. Wow. Yeah. Should we head on up? Just relaxing down. Gently tune into the space. Closing our eyes. And because of the type of meditation we're going to do, it helps to have your internal gaze slightly downcast. We're working on samadhi here, concentrated awareness. Start with our little Buddhist mantra first. Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sanghaya. Namo Nama Nam Hung. Just settle that quiet intent to stay with the practice into your heart. I'm not really sure where the subconscious is, whether it's necessarily all in the brain, whether some of it's in the body. Let's start with our body scan. And take our minds down into our feet. Feeling all the sensations there, both inside and on the surface. And even here we might pick up the playful pull of the mind as it takes us away, so just bring the mind back. Awareness of the sensations, wherever you've got to in the body. Picking up all those tiny little tinglings of energy. We work up through the ankle bones, those parts of the body where the sensations feel less, have to work even harder. And up into the shins and the calf muscles. And working through into the knees. Any tension at this stage, just let it go. Notice it. And mentally will it to let go. Work up along the thighs and the hamstrings. And into the sitting bones, sinking into the seat. Feeling yourself connected with the earth through the seat, nice and safe. Nothing to take us off track right now. The only potential thing is our own minds. So for this short period of time, we feel the safety of the moment and stay with the meditation. Let the head drift up a little and feel the spine coming nice and strong, and a sense of freshness comes into the mind. Come into the stomach and heart space and just explore the emotions that are there. Are there any battles going on between the emotion that's driving your commitment to the meditation, the emotion associated with any doubt? Just notice it. Up to the shoulders. Let any tension melt out. And our awareness travels down our arms, into our hands and our fingers. Then back up to the head. And we explore the scalp. Any sensations we can find. noticing those tiny little sparks of energy. Come into the face. So often the face expresses our mind state. But the two work hand in hand. If the face is smiling, the mind state will be relaxed and soft. Compassionate gaze behind the eyes. Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. Bring the awareness to the breath, just gently breathing, not modifying it. On each out-breath, hear the word still, echo in the mind and settle in the body. Still, just the breath. Take a notice when the mind wanders. Bring it gently back. Just the breath. Still. gently let go of the word, bring all of your concentration to the very tip of the nose where the breath enters and leaves, centering your awareness there, just the breath, nothing else matters. Noticing when the mind pulls you away, bring it gently back. Just the breath. Concentrated, gentle awareness of the breath. Nothing else matters. we just bring our awareness gently back into the room, feeling the space around us. Awareness of friends sitting with us. We offer ourselves a silent resolution to take this practice of gentle mindfulness and compassion out into our day. Like ripples in a pond, we make a difference. Om Mani Padme Hum. When you're ready, open your eyes.